growth requires more than capital.
Why do we call it the cheat code? Nobody said growth had to be fair.
Revenue solves everything.
Welcome to the cheat code. What was our fastest path to revenue?
We tend to like to do things the hard way.
What's the cheat code? It's giving yourself an unfair advantage over the others.
What is it that really works, and how are we going to grow these organizations?
That's our cheat code.
Hey, hello, welcome. You're back on the cheat code. Joined today by Mr. Sean Kester. Josh is off vacationing or having some sort of fun. Just actually complete lying fabrication. He's moving today, so he's not having any fun. Sean, thanks for joining me here this morning. And we've got a great guest as usual lined up. Really, you know, super seasoned sales leader, mentor, has been around the B2B space forever, co-founded and operated a ton of different organizations, but currently the CEO and founder of Scott Least Consulting. Welcome, Scott Least, to the show.
What's up, guys? Thanks for having me.
Hey, man. Thanks for joining. Absolutely. So we always like to hop kind of right into it here. The show is called The Cheat Code for a reason. So as this season two focuses on partnerships explicitly, curious, what is your partner-centered cheat code?
My partner-centered cheat code. So with what I do, I was telling Sean earlier that I work with early stage companies from all over across all different sectors. These folks come my way and inevitably they say, what CRM should I use? What enablement tool should I use? What whatever tool should I use?
It's always good to buy technology first, right?
Yeah. And so what I've done is I've partnered with all of the main providers of all these technologies that I know everybody's going to buy. And I've got myself in their referral program. So I've got affiliate links and whatnot. So I kind of don't care which one somebody buys. So I usually sort of say, I'm trying to be agnostic here, but here's the couple people that I think you should talk to for this particular tool. Happy to make an introduction to all of them. One of them, what do you want to do? And, you know, inevitably they say, well, which one do you prefer best? And then I think to myself, well, which one do I have the best relationship? Who pays me the fastest? And then I kind of nudge them that way a little bit. And so they end up buying something, everybody's happy, and I end up double dipping and getting paid. And I drove $1 million to Gong in 2022 that particular way. And I was a number one partner seller to Aurum last year doing this particular motion. So that's a little cheat code for anybody who's looking to make some extra side cash.
And so is there, you mentioned Gong in there, which, you know, we're big fans of call recording. I think that's strangely one of the first questions that we ask when we're kind of diving into the effectiveness of an existing go-to-market strategy, like because we want to get that context. Is there kind of a recommended tech stack or an order that you suggest organizations think about that in?
A little bit. I'm not a huge tool person. I don't want to over-engineer things. I sort of think about what are the bare bones basics, right? So the first thing is we need a list of some sort. Who are we going to call, right? Mm-hmm. I suppose there's some industries you can get away with just scraping the internet, whatnot, doing something on your own. But, you know, you need some sort of data provider, LinkedIn Sales Navigator, Zoom Info, whatever. So that's number one. You need a CRM probably to track all this kind of stuff. Don't care which one, HubSpot, Salesforce, whatever the other ones are these days.
I was going to say, are there any others? That, I mean, we never run into anything beyond those two.
Yeah. Apparently somebody uses Zoho still, but so one of those. And then there's like, you know, enablement platform like SalesLoft and Outreach and these types of things. And then depending on the stage that they're at, I often tell them you don't need anything else yet, right? But if you're a little bit farther along, you need probably some type of call recording software, maybe some type of dialer kind of thing. And that's about it for me when I'm talking to early stage companies. I'm trying not to push too much on them. We all know that most people buy these things and utilize about 5% of their capacity anyway. So
yep.
I tend to be kind of conservative on this stuff. But that's kind of the initial way that I think about it.
I'm curious, and even would love to get both of your takes on this, like in terms of like partner technology, because obviously we've seen, you know, Reveal and Crossbeam and the PartnerTap and just like a huge inflection of potential purchases flood into this space. And I'm curious, like, what do you guys think about those types of platforms in general?
Go ahead, Sean. I'll let you take that one first.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, it's come a long way. At first, it was spreadsheets and, you know, shared documents. I think when you think about different types of partnerships, there's a couple different motions. One, you usually start with some sort of referral program. Honestly, something like a Google form works good at the beginning, then it'll go into a spreadsheet. But as things get a little bit more complex and as the deal cycles get more complex, there's PRM systems out there, which is called partner relationship management. It's basically a CRM for your partnership motions. And then, you know, one of the biggest value adds that I found in those is co-marketing kits. So it allows you to go and co-brand pieces of content, because a lot of these early stage motions are like, hey, here's a one pager for us, put your logo on it when you go talk to your customers or you want to take a referral and start branding those things. That, to me, was some of the technology that we adopted earliest. There's a lot of different ways that you can do it, especially if you're co-selling. But if your motion is pretty simple and you're just doing referrals and co-branding, and then even just form fills for sending referrals over, when things get a little bit more complex or when you're trying to actually evaluate the propensity of a partnership and its success, then things like Crossbeam and some of those technologies that do account mapping, and it'll show you overlaps in opportunities and current customers and pipeline and things of that nature, can then kind of structure, you know, where you spend the most time. You know, it's very similar to how the sales engagement space took off, you know, 10 or so years ago. I feel like this partnership technology is in that kind of same flux, where everyone's talking about it. It's something that a motion that everyone needs to have, and now there's technology to support it.
I would draw a little bit of a distinction between the sort of PRMs that Sean was talking about and more of the like go to network nearbound kind of platforms.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing that I think nobody has nailed is all these things have been built for the company, for the vendor, not for the connector, if you will.
Yep.
So I'll pick on Sean and SalesLoft for a second, because I've been a partner of theirs for God knows how long. I remember when it was Sean and Kyle and us.
Not
having
a lot else.
Nothing else, basically. I remember having drinks in Utah one time randomly about talking about this. Anyway, once I submit this lead, let's say, and it gets approved, that fucking thing goes into a black box. And there is no transparency or information coming my way whatsoever as to what's happening. Did the meeting happen? Was it positive? Did a contract get set? When's it expected to close? What's the potential dollar amount? Oh, it did close. And that dollar amount, can you remind me of what I'm supposed to get paid? Cool, I'm supposed to make $1,000. When would I actually expect that to come through? Nobody has built that part yet that I'm aware of. And that is a massive hole, in my opinion, in the market. Because the first person who does, I'm all over that. Because if somebody's doing this motion on their own the way I am at scale with lots of different companies, I need that. Because let me tell you, my mini whiteboard over here or my, you know, post-it notes or whatever, it's not doing it for me.
Right? I thought you were pointing at the tequila back there.
This is what happens when people don't tell me what I'm getting paid and when I'm getting paid. I end up adding to the tequila bottle. Right. So that's a big hole when we're talking about all these kinds of companies and platforms and whatnot. And Sean, to me, is spot on. He says there's like, you know, these kind of go to network nearbound companies are having a moment, if you will. It's important to understand why they're having a moment. They're having a moment because the traditional methods of go to market do not work as good as they used to. It's an undeniable fact. I'm not sitting here saying everybody should stop cold calling, it's dead. Everybody should stop cold emailing, it's dead. I'm not saying that. But you can't deny that pickup rates on cold calls are lower than they were 5, 10, 15, 20 years ago. And the same with response rates over email. And that's why people are searching for an alternative. And this traditionally super strategic enterprise motion of utilizing relationships to break into accounts or influence accounts has come down the hill. And it's not just big strategic deals. Now it's low enterprise and mid-market and SMB and hell, even some kind of local transactional kind of sales orgs are utilizing this motion. That's why these companies are having a moment.
Yeah, I think there's two big points there for me. Like number one, they are having a moment. I think the challenge is like no one tracks what I would call partner attach, which is just understanding like what technologies, what partners, what vendors, you know, like this target account is using. Like that is a lot of what's being kind of cobbled together with like this list exchange. If people just started tracking that as a fundamental aspect it within CRM, which, you know, we did for years, like we would technoscrape, we would, you know, get lists from analyst firms and so on and just build that knowledge around the account. And then you knew who to reach out to prior to trying to make that cold call or inviting them to an event and so on. So you could start kind of building those relationships and leveraging them. Like that's like a no-brainer job one that I think any organization should be doing. Second, to your point, like, and there is a startup I'm tracking that does exactly what you're talking about. Like, think of it as a deal room that stays attached throughout the buying and selling process. So like, oh, I've got, you know, these, I want to bring in, you know, let's say I'm a consultancy because that's kind of my past life. Like I'm going to bring in the technology provider that is enabling the service we want to deliver. I'm going to bring in, you know, a relationship that I have, you know, that used to be their boss at a previous company. I can add them into that deal room. It also gives you the ability to say like, all right, who are they? What's their pain? How are we approaching this? Like, what are they trying to accomplish? So you get like all these different aspects brought into one place, and it follows that through to your point. Like, oh, I helped open that door, you know, to the decision maker. What became of that? Where's that in the process? And what I really love about it is that gets translated as like the implementation plan for that organization. So like, what did we actually want to accomplish? Because so often those conversations take place at a certain level and then they get pushed down into like folks to implement and go make it happen. And before you know, you've lost total line of sight into like why that check got cut in the first place. So it's just a really great concept. It's an organization out of Chicago called Sangria, super early. But I love the concept. It probably, unfortunately, won't get the traction it deserves because like it, I don't know who the buying center for that is necessarily. I think that's one of the challenges they're working through, but like, I absolutely love the concept.
Well, you should introduce them to me because I can help them.
For sure.
I think it comes down to a cultural thing though, within the business itself, is if you don't have a culture of partnerships, you need the people to be care enough to talk to them. If I'm the rep and I get a lead from Scott Lease or any other partner for that matter, I should be feel the onus to go and make sure that Scott understands what's going on with that so I can get more of them, right? Like if it goes to a close and it's got positive interaction, and that starts with kind of the culture of the sales organization itself, because oftentimes partnerships is on this island where they're trying to do all this coordinating, but you know, as you start to scale that partner program, you can't be that middle person the entire time, that you need to have direct communication between the partner and the rep itself or post sales or whoever it may be. And so I think, you know, you can have technology to enable it, but unless you have the people that care about it in the process in order to institute it, you know, it's just going to be another layer of technology, which will end up just like shelfware, like so many other things that they have in their stack.
So Scott, I'm curious, you know, like, and I love that approach in terms of like pre, you know, vetting these relationships and determining like not only what's going to be the best fit for the buyer from a technology perspective, but like from a relationship perspective and like, do they respond? Do the deals move forward? You know, do I get paid at the end of the day? How do you ever run into friction points where people are like, hey, aren't you getting compensated on this? Like, you know, do you have a perverse incentive to send me into this direction versus another?
No. I really don't. First of all, I'm pretty transparent about it. So maybe
the reason I bring that up is I think that's like the biggest like false flag. And like, you know, I hear that as an objection all the time. Like, oh, if we take in, you know, which, you know, we used to do the same thing, we'd pay the absolute lion's share, 80% plus out to the referring individual because we wanted them to do more referrals because we knew if we got more, you know, legs into a customer, it was always going to forge a better relationship. But like, as I'm even thinking like post-acquisition, like people looked at this and they're like, this was perverse incentive and, you know, people are going to see right through this. And my response was, they don't care.
Yeah,
like,
they don't.
They want to know like, hey, who you have the best relationship with, yeah. And you should be compensated for opening that door.
I would say not only do they not care, more often than not, they're like, good for you.
Right.
You know, I get like kind of positive feedback that's like, good for you that you've kind of sorted this out. So, you know, and I try to take some care, like I said, not to shove one option down their throat, which is why I've signed, you know, kind of affiliate deals with lots of people in each category. So I can say, here is what my opinion, the top three are. I don't really care which one you pick. Candidly, I get paid either way. Oh, you can evaluate them. You know, you could take a demo with anyone you want. No big deal, right? So I've never really run into, I can't think of a single time I ran into serious friction.
Yep.
In this area at all. Really haven't.
Same.
Yeah.
What's an example, and you can be agnostic and not, you know, you can be anonymous about it, but what's an example of a really good partner experience that you've had and some things that they've done right in that process, just from you being the partner to them?
Well, a vendor. I'll use you and your former employee.
But I'm pumped.
Well, you're as a
yeah, set that up.
you probably, I mean, I know you weren't trying to tee me up, but like I met Kyle and Sean, I don't even know what year it was. It might be 2012 maybe, right? And there was an effort made to keep that relationship alive, just like check-ins, whatnot, quick call for advice. I think one time Sean and I met for breakfast or lunch in San Francisco when we were both there or something like that. You know, I went out to Atlanta and spoke at their conference one time. Kyle, you know, remembered that I was a San Francisco Giants fan and like sent me a signed Willie Mays picture for my birthday one time, just like little shit like that. While I'm, you know, sending clients their way, you know, my partner, Jean Marie Wilkie, who is in RevOps, Sean probably remembers her. She mm-hmm. like gets invited into the CAB, like customer advisory board. And she's like pushing the product team. We brought it into this startup that we're using. So it's just like the relationship is there. By contrast, I know plenty of people at Outreach. A couple of them I'm friendly with, but I've never had a one-on-one conversation with the CEO of Outreach. I've never had a one-on-one conversation with their former CRO, Mark, whatever his last name is. I don't want to mispronounce it. Right. And so I felt like the effort is not coming that way, but it is coming from this way. So mm-hmm. if push comes to shove, I'm going to lean into that one. Another good example is Gong. One thing Gong does really well is when I said to them, hey, whoever wants to message me, have at it. They took that literally because their reps DM me all the time. They're not waiting for like their partner manager or their VP of sales to like go through this particular channel. I mean, I'm getting fucking emails and text messages and LinkedIn DMs from random reps all over the place, right? And when a deal would close, they would tell me, this deal closed. Here's what you should, you know, be getting paid, and here's what day you should be getting paid. By contrast, I've done some of these things for big, huge CRMs, HubSpot, Salesforce. Have you ever got paid on net 180? I have. And I'm like, this is the least motivating thing I've ever heard of in my entire life. I don't even remember.
And normally you have to go chase it down.
Yes. So when I have to put forth that effort, I'm like, oh, come on, man. You don't care about me. You don't value this relationship. Maybe you don't have to. You probably don't have to. Fine. But guess what? I can take this particular business elsewhere. So
yeah, when you think about
good and bad examples there.
When you think about, to your earlier point, like how difficult it is just to get a deal done these days, like the potential that you're missing out on by not investing that just proactivity in that effort is huge. Sean, I'm curious, like how much of that did you have to facilitate as, you know, the head of partnerships, and how much of that just kind of happened organically?
Which piece of it? The getting paid piece?
Yeah, like more like threading throughout the organization. Like, yeah. You know, to get a CEO to reach out, like I feel like for some organizations, it's like this monumental effort. And like for others, like the executive team gets it and like will make that, as long as you make something visible to them, they're going to take the initiative and do it.
So Kyle was unique in that position in that he understood the value of that relationship, specifically with Scott and a handful of others. And so he would make sure that I was helping facilitate him to any of those introductions and having those relationships and those conversations. And what is this person into and what are their interests? And are they going to be at this conference and make sure that we have a time to meet, right? So he was always on me for those things. Now, what I had to do was everything in the middle of it. So I'd make sure that I facilitate those things and make sure that he has those opportunities to do it. But we both understood the power of it. And so he would always take a moment, no matter what, to make sure that he had those relationships there and they were ongoing. So he was really good in that. He instilled that within other leaders in that organization in a very positive way. From the actual like nuts and bolts of like getting people paid, I had to chase down finance all the time. Now, our finance team is notorious, and I'm sure most of them are, of not paying things early, right? No one wants to pay early. And if anything, they're going to pay it in day 91, right? If it's a net 90 term. And so I had to make sure that those things got paid and had to make, and had to kind of portray the importance of like, listen, this person went out of their way. This deal took forever. There's no way this would have closed without them. We need to get them paid now, right? And so, and I'd have to loop in, you know, they often said that I could play the Kyle card because Kyle and I were very close. So I could play that card whenever I needed to. I probably overplayed it. But when something was like, get someone paid, like that was a reasonable time to do it. That it is a struggle though. And I know talking with other organizations and their partner teams, like that's always the struggle piece of it because, you know, finance is sitting there and they're trying to withhold as much money as possible. Sales is trying to get, you know, trying to use the partner as much as possible without them getting compensated. And I'm in the middle trying to manage both those, you know, all those relationships. And so very difficult thing to do. But again, you know, and I'll harp this point as many times as possible. It starts, you know, from the top down from a cultural perspective.
Yeah. I was going to say, like, it just goes back to that, you know, really edict that we've revisited time and time again, that like you have to have an executive team and a CEO bought into this process because of that leeway that you need internally to play those cards that you mentioned.
Yep.
So so you kind of, Scott, you touched on some horror stories there, but I'm curious if you've got some other interesting horror stories of just partnerships gone absolutely wrong or, you know, what should be a, you know, we've talked about a shortcut, should be a cheat for them to leverage these types of referrals. And then, you know, unfortunately the ball does get dropped.
Well, the cheat is, let me think of how to phrase this. The mistake is thinking you don't have this kind of network, if you will, and therefore doing nothing about it because you have your VCs or your board. Traditionally, that's where a lot of people's first deals come from anyways, but then most people stop right there. It's like, okay, well, what about advisors that you have? They probably have a network. They might know some people. What about your employees? True story. I told one of my clients, why don't you put your prospect list in front of your employees? You never know when an engineer might know somebody. Dude was in the same fraternity in a school with two prospects, opened up $900,000 of pipeline for them. Like, overnight. Never would have happened if they didn't look internally. Engineer had no idea. They don't even know who they're trying to sell to half the time, right? What about influencers in the space? Depending on who you sell to, but you know, if you sell to marketers, why not form a partnership with the top 20 marketers on LinkedIn? If you sell to salespeople, why not form a influencer partnership with the top 20 people there? Give them some equity, give them some cash, right? Rather than just asking one, me, why not ask 20 different versions of me who we know? What about involvement in micro communities? There's a million of them, from Pavilion to Thursday Night Sales that I ran for years to Rev Genius to whatever. Just get in there and be like, hey, anybody know anybody here well enough to make an intro? We're paying 20% on first year's ARR. People will jump at this kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So the cheat is, keep asking. If you cold called 20 times in a row today and nobody picked up, would you stop? Of course you wouldn't stop. But why do people stop the partnership angle or the referral angle when they put one list in front of one person and it didn't yield?
Which is a lot more enjoyable than cold call.
Yeah, for sure. 100%. Right? So, and you know, another thing to think about is the bigger your ticket, the more motivated everybody is. You know, if Sean is a founder and he's coming to me saying, Scott, I'd love to part with you on this stuff, but he sells $200 products. For me, I'm not motivated by 20 bucks, 10%. It's not doing it. But if he's selling $200,000 deals and I can get 20 grand just from making an introduction and helping a couple people out, now you got my fucking attention, right? So the bigger the ticket, the more motivated people are going to be. right?
Yeah, and, that's a good point. Coming back to the finance thing as well, you know, 8 or 10 or 12K may not seem like a lot to a large enterprise organization, but like that's a game changer. If you're a rep and you're making a referral and you can get, you know, 50% of that, yeah. You know, again, like that, sure. That used to be a meaningful, you know, portion of comp that we would unlock. And, you know, everyone used to be like, why don't we keep more of that money in house? Like we're getting the ancillary services wrapped around this stuff. Like I want people doing exactly what you mentioned, like sharing the prospects they want to get into, yeah, within Slack, you know, looking at deals that are in flight and saying like, hey, how can I grease the wheels over there and so on. Like that transparency is just so critical.
The last cheat would be, you know, to measure it. We all we measure everything, but we don't measure this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Not well. Do you know, I'll put Sean on the spot because I know the answer. At least I think I do. Like, did you measure the effectiveness of partners like me against each other when you were at Sales Loft? Did you
not one-to-one? It was one of the hardest things to do because the data doesn't live anywhere, right?
I know. That's what I'm saying. We don't, yeah. But you could, in theory, you can manually, mm-hmm, cobble it together. So Sean, for sure, would know, okay, we have 100 versions of Scott. Here's how many deals that they all sent. Here's how many deals actually closed. I'm going to lean into the relationships that performed better and zoom out of the ones that didn't. Right?
We knew it anecdotally, right? And we also just knew who we liked working with better.
Yeah.
Which is another big
factor. But now I think we're at a place where we should start applying science and data and reasoning, absolutely, and logic to this type of stuff. So you want to be more effective in this channel, measure the fucking thing. Right?
Yeah. And again, serve that up against, you know, non-partner involved deals. Like I guarantee the velocity will be quicker. Yeah. The deal size will be larger. The
close rate will be higher.
Yep.
Yep.
Yeah, I mean, it's just no-brainer stuff like that. And the other thing that we used to do was, you know, display that, you know, referral comp, you know, in the same way that we would do, you know, top performers for that month.
Transparently. Like, because with some people, that will motivate them. Yep. I'll tell you right now, if Sean would have put some data in front of me that said, Scott has earned 75K this year, but, you know, Justin has earned 85K, I'm the type of person that's like, I gotta find another deal.
Yeah,
I'm
what was that person doing? You know,
I'm like super close to number one, or like, what is he doing differently than me? Like, mm-hmm, I want to do that, mm-hmm, right? Especially if he was like number one partner seller this year, gets a bonus, or gets to go to our President's Club event, or whatever the heck it is, right?
That's another thing. Like, I don't know why, like, organizations don't do a better job of recognizing referral partners in like SKOs and those types of format, and inviting them to, you know, President's Club trips and things of that nature. Like that's just like a no brainer to, again, unlock free revenue.
Yeah.
Yep. I think the one more thing that's really important is socializing those wins internally and making sure that other reps understand the success that you're having through partners. Because more often than not, you're usually going to find a handful of reps, maybe one or two, that are willing to work with partners at first while you get your partner program started, because it's a bit riskier. The lead may not be as good or as quality. But once they start getting some wins and you socialize those things, people start sniffing it out. Like, hey, how's so-and-so closing all these deals? They don't have to try as hard. They're getting all these extra leads, you know, not just from their SDR, not from their own prospecting. And then making sure that that's visible internally helps the success of that program, not only at the rep level, but also the executive level.
For sure. Like the thing I've found that's like pretty pervasive is like AEs initially, if they don't understand the power of relationships and partner referrals, they think that everyone thinks that they do, but like they will make any excuse not to involve a partner. Like I was on a call the other day with a Portco, and one of the AEs like, well, they're not happy. You know, they have a vendor software that we complement. Like, well, they're not happy with them, so I don't think I should bring them into the deal. Because that could potentially hurt my deal. I'm like, dude, like, why aren't you reaching out to them and explaining they have an unhappy customer that, you know, and in that case, it's actually something that we can solve for with our technology, like forge that partnership together and get them thinking like, hey, if I've got any, you know, at-risk accounts, I want to be bringing these folks into it because they can actually resolve that situation. So like, you really do have to show people on a, you know, case by case basis. And that's, again, one of those things where I love call recording so much, because you can be like, listen to this conversation. Like that's how you, you know, sniff out and identify opportunity.
For sure.
So Scott, I'm curious, like, and you kind of alluded to this already, but like, what do you say to people that are just like, that are in your position that are like trying to get started, you know, and leverage, you know, programs like this that, you know, as we mentioned these days seem to be, you know, something that's kind of a no brainer, but, you know, so many folks have trouble getting off the starting line. Like, what advice do you give?
You know, don't overthink it and just take action. There's not a single vendor that I know that if you reach out to them and say, hey, I might have the ability to send some deals your way. Do you have any kind of affiliate program? There's not a single vendor I know that will say no. They'll all say yes, or they'll say, well, we don't have one yet, but we could put something together right. Real quick. So you can proactively reach out to these companies. Think about whatever tools you have used over the years that you love. Just reach out to those companies. Start there, right? That's number one. Number two, you know, in order to use this motion appropriately, you actually have to have a network yourself. So if you have neglected a online network in particular, you can't run this motion. So I would make network growth a daily KPI for myself. I would send out whatever LinkedIn's maximum is every day. I think it's like 15 connection requests or something like that before they think you're gaming the system. I'd send that out. I'd track it, right? Add 5200.
Do you still do that at this point? Like how much of your day is put towards ensuring that you're kind of...
I can't because I've been maxed out of connections for years. So until you get to 30,000 connections, you should be doing that every single day. And in doing so, you'll literally change your life if you do it and put energy and effort into it. So I don't like hearing from people who say, well, I don't have a network. Well, freaking do something about it then.
Right.
You know, go add people every single day. I'm not telling you to go create content 7 times a week and try to be an influencer. I'm literally just saying, go connect with people. Anybody who might hire you one day, you might hire one day. Anybody who could be a prospect one day, just be kind of indiscriminate about it until you get to 30,000. Clean it up later if you want to adjust who's in your network. Get a sizable network going. And now you have the ability to connect more people, to make more intros, to help more people out, right? Those two things are the simplest pieces of feedback and actionable tips I can give to somebody. There's nobody listening who can't do those things starting today.
Right. That's such a valuable asset. That's, to your point, constantly overlooked.
Yeah. Just effort. People get overwhelmed. You know, they see something as like a big, massive effort, and they can't see that the simplest little steps actually start them on that journey and can yield a reward. You don't have to start off doing this motion trying to think, well, how do I make 100 grand through affiliates this year? You don't have to do that. How do you pay one bill off this month through this motion? That's what I was thinking of. I made 150 bucks, I paid my cell phone bill. Great. All I did was make an intro. It's one less bill I had to pay. Start small, then build up to it. Right?
Makes total sense. So, hey, as we wrap up here, I'm curious, what are you most excited about? And this could be across the board. Like, what are you most excited about today?
What am I most excited about today? I'm most excited.
You just can't give the cop out AI answer. That's the only thing.
No, I'm definitely not. Actually, that's the thing I'm least excited about. If we want to flip this whole conversation on its head, that's the thing I'm least excited about. Because I am one of these people who is looking into the future and not seeing amazingness. I'm seeing a dystopian future where we don't
know. You're seeing Terminator 2.
Yes, I am. You can't tell me that in 7 years or so, 7-8 years, when the power of these AI tools is 128 to 256 times more powerful than it is today, that the AI won't understand tone and sentiment and mood and be able to pick up on human emotions and cues. I just, I don't see how that won't happen. So you're going to start off with the elimination of menial admin kind of jobs, right? Mm-hmm. And the last ones that will be at risk are the big, huge sellers and the deals where you've got to have these, the nuance involved and all that. But come on, one day, humans won't care about buying from humans. Mm-hmm. The reason I know this is because my kids who are 14 and 16 do not give a shit about buying something from humans or interacting with humans. They prefer not interacting with humans. So when they are the CEOs and C-level executives of the future, they're not going to care. They're not going to be like, oh, I have to talk to a person. That's the excuse or the logic I hear from sellers all the time. Humans will always buy from humans. No, they won't. Says who? You might, because you're a 46-year-old right. man like me. Your kids, I don't think they will. So I flipped your question on its head. That's the thing that I'm least excited about is AI.
Makes sense. So I was reading this article the other day that drove me nuts. Like it's speaking about like the differences in generations and so on. If you use punctuation in a text message to someone who's Gen Z, or I don't even know what the younger generation of Gen Z is, but they view that as being curt, as being rude. And I was like, dude,
really?
I can't use periods in my text message now.
If you just give a thumbs up on a text message, that's rude.
It can seem.
I mean, I honestly feel that that's a little bit rude too sometimes, just because it doesn't feel very sincere. It's almost like someone saying sure back, like you say something meaningful and they're like, sure.
Yeah, like, but you're in that cohort. Answer. You know, when Scott said you guys connected in 2012, I was like, you spoke to Sean when he was 16?
I feel like it's rude not to put punctuation in text messages.
That's because correct. You're old. That's what I've been saying. Yeah. That's because you're old.
But I'm on both sides.
I also think you have to buy from, you know, high ticket items from a person, but you know.
Yeah, right. That's good. I just bought a seven-figure property in Chicago, Illinois, an investment property. I never talked to a single person. Didn't talk to a realtor on the phone. Didn't talk to a lender on the phone. Didn't talk to a title company on the phone. Nothing.
Huh.
That never would have happened years ago.
Correct.
I am interested in how you did that.
Did you have to pay both realtor parties?
Well, sadly, yes.
Yeah.
I'm looking forward to the day that is no longer. Well,
but we can get a whole diatribe on that. I'm fascinated by what's going on in real estate. So, hey, man, where should people go to find you, connect with you, hear about dystopian AI predictions?
Yeah, the easiest place to kind of follow along with what I'm up to is on LinkedIn. I respond to everybody who sends me a message over there. And, you know, if you're looking for a alternative to like the Dream Forces and Sasters of the world, I put on an event a couple times a year down in Costa Rica. It's called Surf and Sales, the Surf and Sales Summit. That's a small micro sales and entrepreneur conference.
How many people normally go to that?
20 per session. Keep That's it real awesome. Small, keep it intimate. Yeah. Have some, you know, I get surf instructors to give people lessons who don't know how to surf, good food, good drinks, good conversation. You learn a little bit, relax a little bit. So check that out, surfandsales.com.
Awesome. Well, hey, man, thank you so much for joining us here today. Like, great insights. Definitely check out that event. It sounds super killer. Connect with Scott on LinkedIn. He's got, you know, a huge network and an approach to networking that you can leverage there. And if you haven't started doing so, I think this podcast is a great impetus to get out there and start making it happen. If you're joining us for the first time, please subscribe, give us a like, give us a share out there. It's how we expand our audience. Scott, thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you, Scott.
Absolutely. And we will check you guys out in the next episode of the GTM Cheat Code. Till next time.
Growth requires more than capital.
Why do we call it the cheat code? Nobody said growth had to be fair.
Revenue solves everything.
Welcome to the cheat code.
What was our fastest path to revenue?
We tend to like to do things the hard way.
What's the cheat code? It's giving yourself an unfair advantage over the others.
What is it that really works, and how are we going to grow these organizations?
That's our cheat code.